Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to The Art Detective with me, Dr. Yanina Ramirez. I'm an Oxford art historian, a writer and a broadcaster, but for the purposes of this podcast, I am your chief investigator of images. Today is very exciting for me. I am with someone who, actually, I can say I've idolised for quite some time, Stephanie Merritt, better known, I think, as SJ Paris. So I fell in love with your books quite a long time ago. I am a bit of a sucker for some historical fiction, and yours is the best.
Thank you.
So pleased you're joining me on Art Detective today.
I'm thrilled to be here, and thank you for your very kind words. Yeah. It's a real pleasure to be doing this.
Well, we're at Hay as well.
We're at the Hay Literary Festival.
Yeah. So it's very apt, you know, talking books and art at the biggest book festival, I think. Anywhere.
I think it is. Certainly one of the most well-known and best established in the country, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's the 30th anniversary this year, so it's very special.
Absolutely. And it's been great fun. So, I'm so glad I can peel you off and do an art detective with you now. But we worked together a few years ago now, wasn't it? We did a talk in Harrogate.
Yes, we were competing.
We were.
To see whose historical period was going to prove the most popular.
You kind of hit the jackpot with getting the Tudors.
I had the easiest job, and yet you won over the audience with your superior skills of persuasion.
Not at all. It was the Vikings. I had the Vikings. The Vikings are cool. What can I say? But we're here today because you are working on. It's the sixth book.
I'm currently writing the sixth book in my series that I write as SJ Paris, which is a late 16th century series of historical crime/spy thrillers, and my main character is the Italian philosopher and heretic Giordano Bruno.
Who I am in love with.
Yes,
have been
good.
For a long
good.
Time.
Good. I'm pretty much in love with him. That's why I wanted to write about him, or at least to kind of transform him into a fictional hero. So I've been following his travels. The series started when he first came to England in 1583. And I wanted to start it there because I thought the Tudor history was probably more familiar to readers, but also because there is this not very well kind of established, but sort of there's a theory that he worked as a spy for Elizabeth's government when he came to England, and I thought that would give the books a bit of context for him to be a kind of an adventurer and an investigator himself. So
he's such a fascinating
like
person to choose, isn't he? I mean, because you've picked somebody who exists or did exist and then created a sort of fictional series around.
Well, he's extraordinary, and the reason I felt able to write this series was that I mean, his life was just so rich and extraordinary and full of incident that the idea that he might have been working as a spy while he was living at the French embassy in London, it seems to me entirely plausible. He was somebody who we know in a life spent largely in exile was one of the places he was happiest was in London, and that was largely because of the freedoms that he enjoyed there to write and to publish books that he would not have been able to publish in Catholic Europe. Mm-hmm. Would have got himself into very serious trouble, as indeed he did eventually. But he really wanted to stay in England. He was desperate to find a patron or to find some work at. He tried to get a job at Oxford, but his experiences at Oxford were not very happy. So he ended up having to go back to France because he was a house guest of the French ambassador. And in 1585, which is where the book that's most recently published, Conspiracy, which is number 5 in the series, that's all set in Paris, because in 1585, the then ambassador, Michel de Castelnau, who was quite a moderate and didn't mind the fact that Bruno was an excommunicated heretic who was living under his roof, he was recalled to Paris and replaced by a much more fervent and conservative Catholic who would not tolerate Bruno's presence there. So Bruno had to come back to Paris because that was his only source of income, was his patronage from Henry III at the time. So so the conspiracy sees him coming back to Paris, and that's the book that's out at the moment.
And that is why we are talking about this particular artwork. Now, as with all these art detectives, I say to my lovely guests, what would you like to look at? And you suggested this. It's one of the Valois tapestries, isn't it?
Yeah, this is an image that I love and which was very instrumental to me when I was writing Conspiracy. It's one of, it's one of Catherine de Medici's tapestries that was, it was made in,
we've got to get 1573,
this particular one.
Yeah.
And
it's one of eight, isn't it? There's a series of eight. Probably the design is by the artist Antoine Caron, but it's executed in the Spanish Netherlands, so it's the highest quality of tapestry working imaginable. In fact, we're setting a bit of a theme on Art Detective at the moment. The last three programs have all been about tapestries or embroideries.
Yeah.
And I think that actually that's quite important, because we forget that for a long period in art, art was not paintings in frames hanging on walls. There was very different sorts of art. There was wall paintings onto fresco.
Yeah.
But also these sorts of things were the highest form of art, weren't they?
And would have been made by women.
Absolutely.
Would have been sewn by women, probably designed, as you said, by a male artist, but made, and all the craft work would have been done by women. But the whole series of tapestries is extraordinary, and they're really one of the kind of most vivid visual sources of court life at the Valois court in the late 16th century.
So this one we're looking at in particular, it's connected with something to do with her son and Poland, is that right?
Her son Henry, who was... So Catherine de Medici, I mean, we must talk about her in more detail, but she is at the very centre of this tapestry. Catherine had four sons. She was widowed quite young. She was widowed in 1559, but then, which was probably the best thing that could have happened to her, because she then basically ruled France.
Absolutely.
As Queen Mother for the next 30 years. And she had four sons who were all sort of completely useless in different ways, or variously sort of syphilitic and failing to produce heirs. And she was the power behind the throne. She really was the force that held France together during these later years of the 16th century, when France is riven by religious divisions, kind of almost in three directions between the Catholics,
the
Catholic League, the Huguenots, and then the kind of moderates.
It is a time of absolute, almost civil war and turmoil.
Yeah,
isn't it?
I mean, it really is. France is on the brink of civil war for years here, and Catherine is the diplomatic force who holds everything together, and she was tireless. She used to ride off on these diplomatic missions all around the country and meet these men with their armies and talk them down from the brink of war. So she really was the most extraordinary woman, and she had these four sons, three of whom became king. And the particular tapestry that I've chosen is her third son, Henry, who became eventually Henry III, who was Bruno's patron. So he's the king who features in Conspiracy. But this particular picture shows him before he became king of France, when he is offered the throne of Poland, which was affiliated. So this is a scene where Polish envoys have come to formally offer Henry, who at the time is Duke of Anjou, they've come to offer him the crown of Poland.
Please have our crown.
Yeah, and they are... Well, he did go and he hated Poland. Yeah. Absolutely hated it.
Polish, you say. This is tough for me.
No, I know. And he actually sort of tried to run away a couple of times. But he'd sort of tried to escape, because they kept sort of catching him and bringing him back and saying, no, you've got to rule here. And he just wanted to go back to France. So he was obviously thrilled eventually when his older brother died and he got the throne of France and he was allowed to come back.
Is he the third?
He's the third son.
I find this whole period in history utterly fascinating. And right from the off with Catherine, you've got this famous name, haven't you, Medici?
Yeah.
And I think for anybody interested in art, that is a big name.
Yeah, Absolutely.
We tend to think of the Medicis being in Florence. They're not rulers in the same way that the King of France is a ruler. They are, it's a dukedom, and not a particularly important one, you could say, but very, very big on the arts. Of course, we can associate people like Michelangelo with the Medicis.
Yeah, of course.
But she comes in to this marriage to the King of France and is really subservient, isn't she? She's just a baby-making machine for years.
She comes in very young. Well, exactly, that was her purpose. But actually, and she didn't fulfill it for 10. She had the most extraordinary. She was married for 10 years
because they were both 14 when they got married, weren't they?
They were very young. She was brought over as this sort of, you know, obviously it was an arranged diplomatic marriage, and she was married to Henry II of France for 10 years without giving birth to any children, and he had this string of famous mistresses that he would parade around the court and had various, you know, illegitimate children.
I'm quite excited by Diane of Poitiers.
Yeah,
she
Diane
excites me slightly. Because she was 36 when he was 14.
Yeah.
And they had this long relationship.
It's all a bit Macron, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. I was working out the date, the ages on that. That's very alarming, isn't it?
Yeah. But he was absolutely devoted to her. And so poor old Catherine had this incredibly, you know, she really was sort of left on the sidelines. And, I mean, it's extraordinary that the marriage lasted as long as it did. And then somehow, no one knows how, suddenly after 10 years, she gets pregnant and she has four sons in a row, which is, you know, pretty good going for a queen. That's what you're there to do, to provide several spares for the throne. And they needed them because, like I said, they kept dying and, you know, they weren't particularly useful when they were on the throne. But
also, wasn't it, because what I find so fascinating about how she then rises as regent is that she was not allowed any diplomatic responsibility while her husband was alive. Diane of Poitiers used to do a lot of correspondence and had power, whereas she was just literally put in a room to make babies.
Yeah.
And then she becomes this formidable politician, doesn't she?
Yeah, she does. She absolutely comes out of the shadows. But it's the other thing I find extraordinary is that she, despite the way she was treated and this life that she had in the early part of her marriage, she was absolutely besotted with her husband, absolutely devoted. Mm. And he was killed in a jousting accident. And she never, there was never any hint of her remarrying. Mm-hmm. You can see in the tapestry.
Well, this is what I love.
She's there in her absolute, in her black widow's gowns. Mm-hmm. And apparently she wore, a bit like Queen Victoria, she wore mourning for the rest of her life. And no interest in remarrying, but that she really had this sort of unseen power. And one of the reasons why we know so much about what was going on diplomatically was that she was a terrific letter writer.
Mm.
She wrote huge amounts of correspondence, personal correspondence, to her friends and to her daughter, her wayward daughter, Margot, who's another whole novel to be written, and already has been, La Reine Margot. But she also writes these diplomatic dispatches. So many of her letters have survived. So that there's quite a wealth of information about her personal involvement.
Mm.
And it's wonderful because in Conspiracy, she's in her late 60s by then. She suffers terribly from gout. She's in a lot of pain. And I wanted to try and convey that. She really does become my favourite character in the book.
Really?
Because she's so, she's so formidable. I mean, she's tyrannical and she is ruthless, and we know this. You know, she is quite happy to employ all sorts of stratagems, including murder. And this is what I love about the Valois court, because we think the Tudors have got kind of intrigue and drama going on.
Oh, it's nothing to Valois, is it?
They make the Tudors look like a kind of Puritan's tea party. It's kind of wall-to-wall incest and poison.
And equally, but, you know, the Medicis too.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
You can take it to any of these courts, can you, at this point?
Well,
I mean, it is such an important time, isn't it? It's a time of great change ideologically.
Yeah.
And I think that unsettles the status quo, you know, what's going on with the papacy, what's going on. There's an awful lot of intrigue. And the courts are tied together through marriage.
Yeah. And
I think what's so brilliant about choosing this tapestry as a focus is that you get all the drama and excitement, I think, of the court, but also the excess, because this is all about excess, isn't it?
But Catherine was famous for, to go back to what you were saying about the Medicis as patrons of arts, she took that very seriously. She loved creating these spectacles. They were known as her magnificence. Mm. And she would borrow hundreds of thousands of écus with her Italian banking connections, because for her it was... She took very seriously the idea that, you know, if there was unrest, you had to put on a show. Mm. If people were whispering that the Valois were you know, on the edge of bankruptcy and that the court was failing and the king was weak, you gave them an enormous show. And she also believed that, you know, it brought people together. So there are some of these court festivals that she put on. And they were, I mean, they were extravagant to the point of, you know, almost like the sort of equivalent of the Olympic opening ceremony that we had, where she would get the most famous and eminent musicians, architects, choreographers, designers. She would bring together, you know, the most famous people in the country to put together these spectacles, and then invite hundreds of people of the nobility from all over France.
Mm. And this is, I mean, this is some of what we're seeing here, isn't
yeah,
it?
Because this is wonderful.
I mean, I just think the more you look at this tapestry, the more you see it. It's exquisitely detailed for a start. I mean, that it is almost like a standalone portrait in the middle, and the focus is definitely Catherine. You can see the whole court sort of spiraling around her. But this sort of set piece stage, I suppose it is, over at the right.
Yeah.
You've got musicians playing on, what is it, some sort of a sculpture?
Yeah, there's a sort of sculpture going on here. And so this one is set in the gardens of the Tuileries Palace, which was Catherine's palace. So she had her palace next door to the Louvre so she could keep an eye on her son.
Good idea, really, with
yeah, absolutely.
Sons.
Yeah, exactly. So obviously the Tuileries Palace is gone now, but probably I'm sure a lot of people will have walked in the gardens. Mm. But so this is what the gardens would have looked like in the 16th century, and I think it's so beautiful. You can see the formal layout and these big fountains in the middle, and you can see people, kind of couples, walking in the gardens and the statues. And she used the gardens. She liked to do a lot of lavish outdoor spectacles. And when I wrote... So there is a set piece. There's a scene in the middle, right, sort of right in the very centre of Conspiracy, where something quite important to the plot happens, but it all takes place at one of Catherine's balls, which I invented. It's a fictional occasion, but it's based on elements of all these different balls that we know about that have survived, because lots of the designs have survived and diplomatic accounts of them have survived.
And of course, this image
and,
also
and these images,
sort of,
exactly.
Yeah, something and equivalent.
The other thing I love about this, so there's Catherine in the centre.
Mm.
She's watching the dancing and the music going on in front of her. And next to her, there's an empty throne. And we presume that's Henry's, but there's Henry in the foreground chatting to some guy. This is probably one of the Polish envoys, but as an image, it's kind of quite telling, because this was, of course, Henry's trouble. He was much more interested in chatting to good-looking young men around the court than he was in actually sitting on the throne and doing his job.
Amazing.
Or at least that is one view of him, but it's one that works very well for the purposes of fiction. Mm. It's...
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
It was good to play on that.
But again, I mean, the lavishness of the court is reflected. I mean, it's so busy. I love the way that you can sort of see the crowd just becoming just a sequence of tiny heads to give the suggestion that there's just hundreds of people here, isn't there?
Yeah.
But then the clothes, the costumes are extraordinary.
Absolutely beautiful.
Yeah.
So you can see the richness and the gold, the gold thread on the dancers. One of the little detail, I mean, it's true, the more you look at it... So there's the crowd all dressed in their finery, standing behind Catherine, watching the dancing. Mm. And then if you look above their heads, there's a whole forest of pike staffs.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because, of course, you know, there was they were in danger permanently. There were a lot of people who would have liked to have got rid of the Valois, and who felt that they were a weak family. Certainly the more conservative Catholics did not appreciate at all the fact that they were relatively tolerant in religious terms. They gave a number of freedoms to the Protestants, and that caused ructions. So it's almost like... I mean, it's interesting because it's something that we're getting more used to seeing now. I was saying to you earlier, we're here at a literary festival, and you look around and there are armed police walking around outside, and it's... I suppose this is the 16th century equivalent. You know, here's... people in their best clothes in a beautiful garden watching these lavish entertainments, watching a ballet that's been choreographed for them, and yet in the back there's this forest of
absolutely
armed guards behind them, because at any minute somebody might lunge for Catherine or for Henry or for...
Isn't it amazing how an artwork like this can preserve that sort of sense of tension just in such a small detail? But the detail reveals, I think, an awful lot. So you've got... it's very cleverly structured, actually. You've got the frame at the front with the sort of... again, very well-executed portrait of Henry up there.
Mm.
Catherine in the centre. And then this great use of perspective, looking right the way down the gardens to the palace that was lost then, presumably. So that's what we're missing now.
Yeah.
And behind us, if we're looking in, that would be the Louvre, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So it's very much rooted in Paris. It's very much rooted in this moment and time. In terms of the court around her... Is there a sense of tension in this that people are potentially against her? How because this is set in 1573.
This one's 1573.
And how were things going for her at that point?
Well, 1573. This was an interesting time, because the year before, she had given one of these festivals. 1572. Mm. Of course, you know, people may know that the... so 1572, she held a huge 4 days of feasting and these magnificent spectacles in Paris for the wedding of her daughter Margot to Henry of Navarre, who later became Henry IV, who was a Huguenot, was a Protestant. And this was extremely controversial. The Pope had not given his blessing, and Catherine thought this would be a very clever strategic move to bring Henry of Navarre into the family and therefore make him docile and, you know, put him under her control, which obviously didn't work, because actually he and Margot sort of hated... well, they had this incredibly, you know, fiery love-hate marriage, which is a whole other story. But 4 days of feasting in Paris for the royal wedding, these wonderful parties, and at the end of that comes... St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre.
Exactly.
And there, a lot of Protestant nobles have been invited to Paris for the wedding, and there is this... no one quite knows. To this day, nobody quite knows. Was it a deliberate ploy? Was it Catherine who gave the signal? Was it the Duke of Guise? All we know is that at midnight on the fourth day, the bells of Saint-Germain rang out, and it was a signal. It was a secret, prearranged signal, because at that point, Catholic troops... went through the city. They tried to drag Henry out of his chamber. He escaped, but a lot of his entourage, a lot of the men who'd come with him, were murdered, and then it just spread through the city, Catholic troops dragging Protestant families out of their homes. And this is the really chilling thing, is that the doors had been pre-marked.
Yeah.
You know, so they... this, and then it spread through the whole of France, and thousands of people were killed. And so this... The time when this tapestry is made, it's a year after this has happened. Mm. You know, there's terrible, and there is suspicion cast on Catherine for having been part of this this massacre. So, you know, this is for the Valois you know, they need to restore their reputation, they need to restore balance and order to France, because this is a, nobody, you know, there have been tensions, but this was a thing that I think shocked even a lot of Catholics,
yeah,
who didn't particularly like Protestants having religious freedom. Nobody quite wanted to see corpses piled up in the street and the Seine running red with blood. So that's,
I mean, we do sort of skirt over the importance of the Bartholomew Day massacre, but it was absolutely extraordinary, wasn't it? The speed and the brutality.
Yeah. I agree. And for me, writing this series of books, I've always had to keep it in mind, because it happened 10 years before my series begins. But one of the key figures in my series is Sir Francis Walsingham, who is Elizabeth's spymaster, who was, you know, a man who was prepared to take quite extreme measures against Catholics in England, was, you know, personally involved in overseeing torture to get confessions. And I wanted to try and understand Walsingham's, you know, background and his, you know, why this man who seemed extremely humane was willing to do that. And, of course, Walsingham had been the ambassador to Paris during the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre, and he and his family, including his young daughter, and Philip Sidney was there at the same time. I think Walsingham's daughter was 4 at the time, and his family, their Catholic troops were banging on the door, and the king sent an armed guard to protect the English embassy, and that's the only reason that they were not murdered. And Walsingham had seen that, and, you know, he'd been in that situation of thinking that people were going to come in and slaughter him and his family, and then presumably having walked out the next morning and seen
the destruction.
Yeah, hundreds and hundreds of bodies lying in the street. And I think that must have had such a profound effect on him. I think he genuinely believed that if there were ever to be a Catholic invasion, if Elizabeth were to be deposed or assassinated, that could happen in London.
Absolutely.
It could happen in the streets of England. And I think everything he did was driven by the desire to protect England from anything like that happening afterwards. Everything he did in his role as Secretary of State. So that the St. Bartholomew's Day cast a very long shadow. And it's there in all the books, but very specifically in Conspiracy, because Bruno meets people who were involved who were there. Yeah,
I mean, I think that's why I'm so enchanted by what you write, because I think that there's that to pick this period is a complicated period in history, and we have a sort of rose-tinted view of the Elizabethan era, I suppose, and we look at it through art, we look at it through Shakespeare, we look at it through literature. We see the glamour and the glitz of the Elizabethan court, but underneath that was just such fear. And I mean, I'm always struck by this idea that Elizabeth I was a hostage in her own palace, that she thought she could die at any moment for most of her reign. And then when you transpose that and you see this other woman as well, Catherine de' Medici, trying to govern in the court of the Valois, which is even probably more of a hotbed of intrigue and drama.
Well, and when you think eventually Henry III of France was assassinated, Henry IV of France was assassinated, it was quite, you know, it was not unusual for a monarch to you know, meet a sticky end at the hands of some fanatical extremist who decided they'd like somebody else on the throne. So, yeah, and when you consider that, you know, people didn't know at the time. And when my books are set in the 1580s, we're only halfway through Elizabeth's reign. People had no idea, you know, of her longevity and had no idea that the Protestant faith would endure. Mm. I think for a lot of people in England, they regarded it as an aberration, and eventually, you know, England would
right
return.
It would go back to the Catholic
faith. It would be an experiment.
Faith.
Yeah. And so there is a sense of, and particularly in the 1580s, there's a lot of, because there's a lot of espionage going on, because there's a lot of plots that do get uncovered, and because until 1586, we've still got Mary, Queen of Scots, hovering in the background as a potential replacement for the you know, those still loyal to the Catholic Church. Kind of, you know, there's Mary who could be brought in, or, you know, freed from prison and brought out if somebody were kind enough to get rid of Elizabeth. So there's this... During the 1580s, there is a huge amount of legislation, which, again, you know, it strikes a lot of chords with what we're seeing today. Legislation coming in to prevent these things happening. So legislation where people can be arrested for treason because of what they are reading. Not necessarily because of anything they've done, but because of what they seem to be reading, because of people they might have spoken to. And there is this idea of surveillance, people being asked to keep an eye on their neighbours. Have you seen anybody, you know, waving a relic around? Or, you know, do you happen to know that one of your neighbours hasn't given away all their, it hasn't got rid of all their prayer books, their Catholic prayer books. So there is a tension, and I think and a sense of suspicion hanging over England at this time as well.
It's interesting you make parallels with the climate today, but in a way, because I see this as a medievalist very strongly, that when you have wars, open warfare or battle between two different people, two different geographic regions, you can distinguish. But when it's an ideological battle, yeah. when it's taking place in people's minds, and you don't know if they are Catholic, Protestant, yeah. what their affiliation is and what they're prepared to do for that, it becomes even more intriguing, doesn't it?
Well, and I think the thing that frightened Walsingham and Elizabeth's advisors at the time, which is very significant or has a very strong parallel with what we're seeing today, is that they feared that these, you know, particularly hot-headed young men who were loyal to the Catholic Church had a loyalty that went beyond their loyalty to their nation and to the nation state. They were loyal to a religious idea that superseded their loyalty to England.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that, you know, we don't even need to spell that out.
No.
It's the same idea that your loyalty to your homeland comes second to your loyalty to your religious faith, and therefore you might be prepared to commit any act of treason against your sovereign, against your fellow citizens.
And I mean, I think that the image that you chose with this tapestry, in a way, that's what I love about it. I love the subtext. I love the I don't love it, obviously, but the sense of fear. And actually, I think claustrophobia. There's yep. a sense in this image that line of pike staff actually is breaking up the natural world. It's taking away from the peace of the garden. It's throwing you into this very artificial, staged area that feels, you know, tense and composed.
Yeah.
And while what I'm sure what the tapestry maker and what the artist were intending to do with this was create an image of great grandeur, of, you know, courtly life, but there's just this subtlety to the division that for me speaks of something more. It speaks of a political situation that's far more volatile, actually.
Yeah, yeah. And it is, and it's all so tied in. You know, everything that's happening in England is tied into what's happening in France.
But because these two of course women Henry. Well, I was going to say, yeah. That's so interesting, isn't it? Do you find that interesting as a female writer writing about these courts that have these strong women in them, or is that?
Well, it is. It's intriguing because, you know, you'd think that would trickle down. It certainly didn't really in the Elizabethan court.
No,
you know, it wasn't. In fact, Elizabeth didn't really like other women yeah. being around, taking attention away. Catherine had a very different approach, and an extraordinarily pragmatic approach. And I was so delighted when I found out about this, because this plays a part in the novel as well. Catherine liked to have her court full of beautiful young women in the way that Elizabeth didn't, because they were very useful as spies. So Catherine had this entourage, and she would sort of handpick these very beautiful, wealthy young women who had come to court as her ladies-in-waiting in the hope of finding a husband. And they were known as her flying squadron.
No!
And, yeah, this fantastic name. So this was a... And she would deploy these women to go and seduce men that she thought might be persons of interest, who she thought might be plotting against her sons, because people always were. And so she would send these young women and to become mistresses of, you know, whoever it was, the Duke of Guise, Henry of Navarre, you know, various different kind of nobles, and then they would report back to her.
Goodness me.
And so and these men were stupid enough to, you know, in their pillow
honey traps.
Yeah. And there was one very significant plot against, not against Henry, but against his brother, Charles IX, his predecessor, which was uncovered precisely by this means. This one guy boasted to his mistress that he and another noble were plotting against, you know, that they had this plan all ready to go. And she went back and told them that their homes were raided, all these notes were found, he'd been telling the truth, and they were both beheaded.
Gosh.
Purely as a result of, you know, careless pillow talk. So they were really great assets to her, and she wasn't afraid. I mean, she was almost like a sort of, for all her own kind of piety and chastity, she was almost like acted like a kind of madam.
Yeah.
And she, some of these festivals that she would put on, these parties, she would put on performances, you know, dances and sort of masks, but very often featuring sort of semi-naked women dressed as Greek goddesses. At one of these occasions, she had all the food was served by topless girls. It was all incredibly kind of raunchy.
Oh my gosh!
For pious Catholic widow,
it's, in a funny sort of way, you do get a sense of that just from the composition here as well. I mean, again, contrasting it with sort of Elizabethan art, where you get the portraiture of Elizabeth and she's sort of this almost semi-divine creature. Yeah. Here, the women are right behind her, but there is such luxury, and the whole, actually the women are part of the court drama, aren't they? They're part of the composition.
So.
I mean, I just absolutely love this image. We could endlessly talk about this, Stephanie. We could keep going, but we have already talked for a long time. It's so exciting the way that you bring this period to life. I love the way that the idea that historical fiction somehow detracts from the fact, to me, has never been the case. I think as you create these people in these worlds, it actually brings them to life in a way that you don't get from dry facts and history. I'm so excited about the next book. When
Thank
are we going
much.
To expect it?
So that's hopefully that one's coming out next year.
Gonna have to wait. I'm gonna have to be patient.
I know. I'm afraid I'm still working on that one, but that one's set in Prague. So that's all moving to the court of Rudolf II in Prague, which is, again, fascinating in a completely different way.
So we'll have to do another one.
Alchemy and magic and wizardry and, all sorts of things going on there.
We'll have to do another Art Detective when that one comes out to
absolutely.
Set it in Prague. But thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you're on Twitter, aren't you?
I am.
People want to follow you.
Yeah.
What's your...
I'm at the Steph Merritt.
At the Steph Merritt. And I'm on Twitter too. You can follow me at Dr. Yanina Ramirez. If you've enjoyed the podcast, why not subscribe? You can go to historyhit.com/artdetective. We've got some very exciting podcasts coming up over the next month. Look forward to giving you more art, more history, and stay tuned, people. Thanks very much. Thanks so much, Steph.
Thank you.
Bye.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.